Welcome to the official podcast of The Next CMO, hosted by Plana, makers of the first AI-driven marketing leadership platform for quickly and easily creating winning marketing plans, maximizing budget impact, improving ROI. The Next CMO is a thought leadership podcast for those that are CMOs or want to become one. My name is Kelsey Kraft, and I'm the Senior Marketing Manager.
And I'm Peter Mahoney, the founder and CEO of Plana, and welcome to the Next CMO podcast.
Today we have Jason Whittup, the VP of Marketing at Metadata. Jason is an experienced marketing ops technology leader known for his MarTech knowledge and developing high-performing teams. Thanks for coming on, Jason.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. This is great. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this, Jason, just because I've heard so much about Metadata and didn't really have a chance to get into it too much. And doing a little research before the call, I got even more excited in that the whole idea of improving the performance of marketing using data is pretty central to what everyone on the planet wants to do right now. So you guys are in a pretty hot area. But rather than me ramble on about what Metadata is, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the company, and also it would be helpful to understand a little bit more about your background so you can mix them in however you want to do them. So tell us about those, Jason.
Sounds great. So I'm Jason Whittup, VP of Marketing at Metadata.io. And I'll start with a story about how I actually became the VP of Marketing here, because it's actually interesting. My background is primarily in marketing operations, analytics. I've been doing it for a long time. I've got a lot of gray hair. And I've been doing it for so long, I was really ready. I'm ready for taking on a little bit bigger role. I'm ready to helm a marketing organization and take all of this experience and knowledge that I've learned over the 20 plus years that I've been doing it and take my hand in it. And also over that time, marketing has become so much more of a data-driven, data-optimized function. And so all that experience that I had in ops and analytics was great experience to have, even in a marketing leadership role. And last summer of 2019, I started hearing about Metadata in my network. So I was working at Workfront, great company, just started hearing about Metadata. And in fact, I was at a conference when those things were still happening, and Metadata wasn't sponsoring it, but it was literally the only thing people were talking about. And I exaggerate a little bit, but it felt that way to me. I was like, they're not even here, and we're all talking about Metadata and what it does and who's behind it. And so, I don't know, a week after that, I'd reached out directly to Gil, our CEO, and just said, I don't know you. I have been doing a little bit of research. I've heard a lot about your platform. I'd love to see if we could work together. And we met up in San Francisco, really saw eye to eye. We saw the problems in marketing. I'd seen these from an operator's perspective. Really difficult time proving ROI. Really difficult time doing just what we all think we should be doing, testing, optimizing. Not enough resources. And then also when you have enough resources, the emotional part gets in there. What wins, what doesn't? It's almost like trading in the stock market as a person, but not a machine. And we just saw eye to eye, and what he was building was exactly what would fix that. And there were like three aspects of the platform. I was like, I've tried to build this at these places I've been, and I haven't been able to. So we started, I started advising in a little advisor relationship with them, and that lasted about 6 months. Really loved it. And then right in the beginning of the pandemic is when I decided to make the leap and come full time, which was also another kind of scary time, but that's why I joined. And Metadata, what we do, we described it a little bit, but we call ourselves a demand generation platform. And we'll talk about that maybe a little bit later, but we really help B2B marketers understand the makeup of customers that they can sell best into. And then we'll run and optimize sets of campaigns across channels using our AI that really just focuses in on what drives the most revenue. That's the most basic way to say it. Of course, there's lots of components of the platform that make that work. But we're really trying to make B2B marketing just more effective, more efficient, and also really just hone in on the quality of demand that's being driven from a platform and not the volume of demand. So yeah, so
that's great. That's a nutshell. No, that's a great place to start. And I'm sure we'll unpack a little bit of that in throughout our discussion here. And one of the things I was going to ask you, though, is having spent a lot of time in these operating roles, and especially at big companies like Workfront, what were the big struggles that you had as a marketing operations leader at a company the size of Workfront? It doesn't have to be specifically Workfront, because I think everyone has the same issues. So talk about the pain points that you had as a marketing ops leader.
Yeah, and in my experience, all the problems are really the same. From I worked at Tableau, Workfront, Microsoft, smaller places, Getty Images, all as a marketing ops person, and all the same problems. The main one, I would say, from an operator's perspective, is all the resources you have working towards a goal, but how those resources are being applied and how much, I'd say, red tape, for lack of a better term, there is that goes on in these organizations that really slow things down dramatically. And so let's say you have a good idea in a big marketing team. You got this great idea. It doesn't fit the mold, you know, of what you've been doing historically. You pitch it, you've got to pitch it to 7 people. You've got to do this big business case. You've got to come up with all of the details just to get approval to try a test out. And by the time you've got all that ready to go and all the approvals, maybe 3 other companies have already done it. You know what I mean? And they beat you to it. And so now you don't get to do that anymore. And they take the other pieces, they have all these resources that they take and they apply it to, okay, let's get this campaign done. All right, we've got, let's say, 7 campaigns through the year we need to get done. And the goals are getting the campaign out the door, not the campaign's performance. So there are goals on the activity,
yeah,
and not the outcomes. And so
we call it the did you do it measurement versus the outcome-based measurement. And exactly. It's a huge problem, especially when you get to a complex organization. As you said, if you've got in a big team where you have a lot of moving parts and getting a campaign from ideation to delivery and result takes a lot. And obviously, and especially if you're people who use Workfront tend to have complex things because that's what it's really good at. And obviously, keeping focus on what the outcome should be is really important. And not only that, not only keeping focused on the outcome, but understanding, is it a good outcome? So that's a big struggle that I think people have, is the difference between saying, hey, I did the campaign is step one, right? It was done. Yay. Step two is, yeah, and we got 100 leads. Okay, is that good or is that bad? How does it compare to other things? What was the cost per lead? What's the value of the lead? So what would the ROI be, et cetera? So really understanding those things. And I know that some big companies struggle with that, but also some small companies do. And in fact, a lot of small companies really struggle with this understanding of what is valuable, what's valuable, and what's good for them. And just because the outcome they've been getting or the cost per opportunity or cost per lead is the number that they've been working toward, is that good? They don't understand if it is or could it be better? So that's a big struggle.
Or they stop there. They stop there and they're like, by that goal, which was maybe it's a CPL number below something or a number of leads I met my goal. Not only did I meet my goal on volume, but look, like the profile looks right too. They're the right company size. They're the right job title and the right departments. But then it's like all of a sudden it's not converting. And that's really where I think there's some of that disconnect. But marketing feels like they're doing their own job, but they're looking sometimes at the wrong metrics or however they've understood their unit economics from like a demo request or even an impression all the way to a closed one deal. They're off, that they don't work out. And yeah, I see that a lot too. I see that a lot as a struggle with these larger companies. But it's just interesting. What was interesting to me coming from these larger companies and moving to a startup is it honestly feels like we're producing just as much output.
Absolutely.
With 2 people in a marketing team that we were with 80 people in a marketing team. And it's just that I know we're not, but it feels like we are. And I would venture to probably say that if 2 people looked at, you know, my website and the activities that I'm doing off outside of the website and a larger company and what they're doing, it would be hard to tell, is the size of the teams different or are they relatively the same size? And so when I started to see that, I was like, I'm able to do a lot of the stuff because there's no approvals. There's none of this red tape. There's an experimentation culture. So I can try something and be okay if it's going to fail, because I know that I'm not going to get fired for it. And it just gets you to doing a lot more activity. And then that activity gets you to the place where you know what works faster.
Yeah. So what one good way to talk about this, Jason, is that the way that you guys organize your products are in this logical flow, the way marketers think. You start with identifying your target audience. What's that all about? Using data to do that. Second is running a series of experiments to see which ones are going to be performant and which ones aren't. What's a good thing? And then third is actually flighting campaigns and acquiring customers, et cetera. So in that sort of phase of things, that should be a familiar set of steps for marketers to think through. The first thing they need to do is identify the target audience. So let's talk about that, because that's a huge struggle. In fact, before we started hitting the record button, we were talking a little bit about ABM strategies and whether you're explicitly doing an ABM strategy or you've at least had a implicit ideal customer profile that you've defined, et cetera, you should have some kind of a view of what that target audience is. So what are the kinds of things that you should consider as you start to build out and refine your understanding of that target audience?
Yeah, and it's interesting because this is an area I get really excited about, because it's so traditionally we're looking at things like all the standard stuff, right? Like industry, revenue, number of employees, just all this stuff that you can find that's pretty readily available. And you get some more interesting things like, oh, maybe they're on the Inc. 5000 list, or you can get some other maybe interesting ways of segmenting. Of course, you've got geography and all that stuff. But those are like the starting point. You know what I mean? Because that should just be the starting point. But the things that are actually going to move the needle in your ICP are probably not those things. They're going to be behavior related things. They're going to be things that are harder to detect, or that might be unique in an industry or a company. And when I talk to a lot of our customers who use the platform, because they still need a marketing strategy. So if they come to us with a bad marketing strategy, we're just going to amplify it. So I try and get on the phone with them and talk a little bit about the strategy. And the audience is really where I focus in, because it's not true, but it's almost true that if you got just the perfect audience, if you really nailed your audience, the message you get in front of them doesn't matter as much. I hate to say that, but because it does, but like almost doesn't. You could almost, if you really get the audience that really needs your thing, and you just give them one pain point message that they're really feeling at that point, that may be all you need to do. But so it's, how do you get to the understanding of these other pain points? How do you know, for example, what we do when I'm targeting people is people that would be good for our platform are usually people that are spending a decent amount of money in paid social, because we really help them optimize in a couple channels, Facebook and LinkedIn. There's really no publicly available data set that I can use that says how much, there's Kantar and like how much do the people generally spend on advertising, but nothing that like, what are they spending in LinkedIn and Facebook? So I built my own. I realized like you can go to a company page on Facebook and LinkedIn, a couple of clicks, you can actually get to a page where you can see every single one of the ads they have in that platform. And so I had a company write a script for me to go out to thousands of these company pages and just count the number of ads and use that as a proxy for how much they might be spending in these channels. And so I'm always advocating, look at your customer data. So when you're trying to figure out your ICP, if you sold enough, great. You know what I mean? So you sold enough, so you've got a great volume of customers that you can analyze and really understand your ICP. But you're going to start by understanding just these standard firmographic and technographic stuff, right? What technologies are you using, et cetera. But then it really is helpful to try and get in and understand these other things. Were they growing at the time? Were they hiring for people at the time that they became a best customer of yours? There's just these other pieces of data. And so then using that, obviously, to then go out and find other audiences that are like them. Other easy ways, things like your current customers, who are their competitors, right? So if your current customers are doing well with your product, their competitors probably will too. That's readily available data. Also, the inverse of that, I always forget this one. Customers, competitors, and then competitors, customers. Yeah.
Yes.
You can use a technology like BuiltWith or Aberdeen, and you can understand technographics. And some of these data sources even have the first month that a technology was detected on a website. So you can infer a contract end date and start to build programs around, I know you use this technology. We often do better than that technology. You might want to check us out, that kind of messaging. Really understanding your audience, but then knowing how to flex that a little bit and getting some additional data so that you can really, and then of course, intent data, which we haven't talked about, which is one of the most important things as you're really creating these kinds of audiences. But
yeah, in fact, I was just having an online discussion. I'm in a group of CMOs who, even though I'm what I call a recovering CMO, and I was just having a back and forth about intent data and the best sources for that. Because obviously, understanding demographics or firmographics is great, but if someone is looking to buy something that you happen to be selling, that's pretty handy. And so can you talk about the kinds of techniques that generically you can do? And actually, it'd be handy to understand also how you guys are doing it metadata, because I think one of the things that people struggle with a little bit around this kind of data work is that they understand at a high level conceptually how this all works, but actually doing it without a bunch of data scientists is pretty tricky. So step one is, what are the right things to think about when it comes to intent data? What are the right sources? And then two, how do you make it actually doable so you don't have to hire 14 data scientists?
Yeah. And there's different flavors of intent now, as there's like companies like Bombora, who you can buy from and subscribe to, and they grab intent oftentimes through these like journal publication sites that people might go to and what content they're reading, and they read all the system reads all the content and kind of comes up with NLP. What are they looking at, and stacks that up, and you can get things like companies surging on a topic and those kinds of things. Then you've got intent from places like G2, right? So review sites. And I actually find that intent is oftentimes lower funnel. And so it's like they're on a G2 website and they're researching alternatives already. And I can capture some of that because I have such low awareness against some of the people that they would normally choose as a supplement for us or a replacement. There's really no better data. And you can get a direct feed of that and the accounts that are, you know, either on your page or on the comparison page or on the category page. And then you can flex your messaging based on that and just add some job titles to the account list. And then you can start to go advertise to them. And then there's first party intent. That's the best intent. So they're on their website and they're reading the pricing page or they're reading some other high value page, and you go and retarget them because you've got a site pixel because they've already been on your site. And so those are really the three kind of intent areas that I play in. I primarily use G2 intent for the stuff that I do, because again, we have quite a bit lower awareness than some of our bigger competitors, and getting them lower funnel. And then as long as I can get in front of them, which my own platform helps me do, then I can usually either intercept or, you know, at least have a conversation or get them to at least see that there's an alternative out there.
Yeah. And what we see, that's a great way to break it down, Jason. And what we see is that I think people are decent at the first party intent stuff. I think people are pretty good at pixeling their appropriate pages and trying to do retargeting and things like that. And that works reasonably well. But obviously, that is people who already know your brand and have been to your website and all that good stuff. So finding the broader universe and filling the, I was going to say the top of the funnel, but the other really important point you made was about the idea that when you're doing a product comparison and trying to decide which vendor is the right one, clearly you're pretty far down your buying journey when you want to look at which alternative is the right one for me. So that's a cool trick to look at. And I want to come back to how to operationalize this, but we should probably try and get to, that was part one. Don't worry, it's three. It's not like 47, but that was part one. So I think, Kelsey, because I know you spend a lot of time on the optimization side for our plan. I think you had a couple of questions about optimization, right?
Yeah. What are some of, you know, the best practices that you use running these experiments and with all this data that you collect?
Yeah. So I'd say, first of all, it's the approach you use to optimize it. First of all, coming in with just a test mindset is the most important thing. So just being okay that 10, 20, maybe 30% of your experiments are going to fail miserably. So just coming in with that. When you think about optimizing, especially in B2B, we all want to optimize revenue, right? That's the holy grail. But unless your sales cycle is like a day, right, which no real B2B product is, then it's going to take longer to understand what actually drove behavior that led to revenue. It's not just going to happen in a one-day sales cycle. And so I think what's important, and we were kind of talking about this a little bit earlier, is really understanding what you're trying to measure at the different stages of these things. And so early on, you're just going to have clicks, you're going to have cost, you're going to have a couple leads probably coming in. And so you start to optimize to that. You start to look at those metrics and you're just like, what are these telling me? But if you only have one campaign and one thing out there, then you don't really know. You just have this one thing. You're left to decide if that's okay or not. And if you haven't set those goals before you started it, then you're basically going to probably talk yourself into it. But then if you've got, oh, look, I've got an MQL now. Oh, I've got an opportunity now. I've got actually a closed one deal after one or two sales cycles. And if you set up the connections between systems properly, you can actually see the campaign influence on those deals. And so that's something that we do in our platform too. We just connect to Salesforce so we can see what were the campaigns that influenced opportunity, a deal, and then look at things like deal size and all those things. And that's really where it gets hard for humans to do this kind of optimization. So it was like easy for us to do optimization 10 years ago because the level of data, the amount of data we had was just like really high level, surface level stuff. Now we have all these like view throughs and we've got every single permutation of an ad and all these things we want to test. And we actually know through all these years of doing it that those things actually matter. So it's worth testing those things. Especially if you're a small team or even a decently sized team, like even the teams I have, these large 20, 60 person ops teams, we struggled with just doing the amount of testing. And so that's, I think, really where the change happens is a lot of people are like, I'm optimizing this campaign. Well, but there's really no way to optimize it unless you have a lot of different things to try. And so it's what are the breadth of things that you can try? And then trying to make it so a human can actually look at all of those different things is just really difficult. So having a platform, having a dashboard, just something that can do most of the heavy lifting on the analysis for you is critical.
Yeah, it's interesting because, Jason, one of the things that I see people struggle with a lot, this is a very similar problem to personalization. The first step in personalization is segmentation. And then, so you've got to figure out how to segment your audience, and then you've got to figure out the map of messages that are appropriate to those different segments and personas, or however you break them down. And when you build experiments, it means you actually have to build multiple things. So you need to understand your audience, and then you need to find out, how do I define a statistically valid segment of my audience that I can go after and run a test? What is the scale of a test that I should be running at any given time? And then how do I actually choose the variables that I need to tweak as I run these tests? And it's the thing that blows my mind is sometimes the tiny little things that make a huge difference in performance. Mm-hmm. And how would to test that particular variable about, you know, how you punctuated or the size of the font or whether you put an emoji in the subject line of an email or whether you use a bright green or you use pale pink. So how do you help people think about that and solve that problem, understanding with all this incredibly diverse matrix of variables that I could think about, how do I start? That's where people, I think, struggle a lot, is how do I get going when I want to start to run some experiments?
Yeah, and the funny thing is, when I first started doing a lot of experimentation in this role, I would have my favorites. I'd like, I really like this one. Let's do this one more. Let's put some money on this one. And then the data would come back, and I was wrong, basically. I was the opposite, basically, of what my audience was clicking on and attracted to and what was working. And so it really just told me this, even though I'm selling to myself, so I'm selling to B2B marketers, usually with an ops, an angle or lens on things. They're trying to get efficient. It's me. Yet what I think is going to resonate is wrong. What I think will resonate with me is apparently wrong. I don't know myself. Oh no. And so that's the first thing I see. And then so when people want to first start getting into experimentation, it's like the main thing is the amount of content that you have to do. You have to actually Absolutely. Get to this point because most organizations are just like, they're already struggling with their content team and resources, just getting one version out the door. And so then when you're like, all right, great. So now we're getting five more. We just need five more like that with just a subtle tweak. And then it's the sky's falling down. And so I think the first hurdle to get over is, and this is one of the hard conversations we have with some of our clients is, do you have enough stuff to test? Because if you only have two versions of something, that's probably not enough. And so we really promote, and this is where we try and boil it down to like component parts. It's, don't think you have to create a bunch of different ads. Like, just what are a bunch of images that you would use? And then what are a bunch of headlines that you would use and calls to action? And then we'll just put those together in all different ways, as long as it makes sense. You don't obviously want to put a headline with a creative that just is totally off balance. You know what I mean? You're talking about one customer and hearing the logo of a different one, but within that realm of possibility, have it run all of those things. And then to be able to have it understand which of those things is having an impact, and then seeing how other campaigns that have that same component are having a similar impact. And this is hard for us as humans to see that granular of data and be able to make inferences off of that when a computer has a little bit better time doing it.
Jason, one thing I love that you brought up is having the mindset to test things. I think if you don't have that fundamental of, as a marketer, wanting to test and being open to trying new things, I know firsthand just from some of our digital campaigns that we're running, there's things that we, you know, brought on board that we wouldn't have thought of it or had the ability to test if we wouldn't have an open mind. So I love that you brought that up because I think it's super important. And as a marketer, that's how you're going to get the data you need to make those data-driven decisions.
Well, and it's scary for people because oftentimes what happens is they're coming from an area of no testing or low experimentation. And so what they've done is they've taken all of their budget and resources and they've assigned it to things that they know are going to work. But then by doing that, you're only guaranteeing average performance because you're basically saying, I know I can do this already because I've done it. And that's how I'm basing this average on. And that's how I'm going to plan my budget because I know what I'm going to get from it. But what you don't know is, what if there was a more efficient way to get that? Or what if there were a completely different tactic you haven't tried or a completely different audience? But the mindset people get into often is, I have a finite set of resources and they don't have a certain percent of that that's basically set to the side that's not required to meet their performance goals, but that's there so they can test. And I don't know if that's 10%, 20, 30, it depends on your budget and like your unit economics, but mm-hmm. That's what I find is where people have a hard time is, but I don't have budget set aside for experimentation. So I need every dollar to basically drive this average. And so until they can separate themselves out from that and be like, okay, this is my 30%. I go around a 30% rate. So about 30% of my budget is not expected to drive results, I guess I would say. But then if I find something in there that does, it goes into the 70% bucket and I start to spend more money on it.
Yeah. The other thing to keep in mind is that you talked about the idea of going straight down the middle and getting the expected performance. But if you don't do some kind of optimization, you will likely see a decay in performance over time. So especially if you're continuing to market to the same audience. And Kelsey, it reminds me of the book promotion we were doing. And it's been our most successful promotion, little plug for the Next CMO, the Guide to Operational Marketing Excellence, awesome book. And nice. We were getting great performance out of our campaigns. And then at one point it started to decay and we changed the ad color. That was the thing that sort of revitalized it and made it pop. It's funny how that can work. I also wanted to follow up on it's a question I hear a lot is, how much should I think about for experiments? And there's probably a pretty big range, as you said, based on a lot of factors of your budget and your expectations. But the idea of 30% will to a lot of people feel like a big number. So if you're saying 30% is an experimental budget, would your expectation be from what, because you guys see a lot of clients, you've got a really, I was looking at your client page, you've got people like Drift and Pendo. And so you've got a pretty heavy digital marketers out there. Do they see, are they running that scale? You don't have to tell me specifically those companies. Are they running that kind of scale of experiments? And when they do run an experiment, what kind of performance boost do you expect to see from running a successful experimental program?
Yeah, oftentimes what we'll see is heavy experimentation up front. So a lot of our clients are coming to us because they want to figure out what works. And then I don't want to do a bunch more experimentation right away. I want to let that go for a while. You know what I mean? And then basically crack it back open when that starts to decay. The scale, what we try and do is especially when we're first onboarding a customer, we really plan out spend. We talk about like, how we're going to pay so that we can get the fast answers the fastest so that we can bake those answers in. But it's not an exact science. It's yet, I would say. And some clients, given their what they sell, their audience, how long they've been doing it, you know what I mean? They might have different performance than others. But as a kind of a general rule of thumb, we try and get to that point with our clients where we're like, hey, let's talk about a certain percent. And oftentimes it's lower than my 30. It's often around 10% of just that budget that you want to continue to experiment with so that you can find the next winner before you need it. And that's really the thing, is don't wait until you need it to then go digging for it. Take 10% of it you've got always, and then always trying to feed new things into that mix. We find that our larger clients, of course, have a lot more content, right? So like our larger clients have more spend, more content. And so it's a lot easier and faster for us to figure out what works quickly. Folks that are with us that are a little smaller, it might take us 2 or 3 months to get to that point where we really understand what works, because we can't pump enough budget through the platform or content. Oftentimes if they have smaller budget, they're also smaller teams. And that's something we're actually trying to figure out. Like, how do we solve that for some of these smaller clients of ours? And what we're doing is we're actually building playbooks now. So like you mentioned earlier, we see across 100 plus customers and what works, what doesn't, what creatives work for them. And we're going to basically start to pull together all of our learnings from that over the last couple of years, and then to try and help out new customers and even existing ones with just these playbooks. We just know this works because we have proof that it does.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's great that you've started to write that down, because I think there's a huge thirst for that kind of information out there among marketers, because the landscape of what's possible and what works in marketing is changing all the time. So it's great to be able to give people some guidance around those practices. So one thing,
we're going to produce them too. We're going to publish them too. We're just going to let them out.
That's great.
Let them out the door to everybody. So yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great approach. And we think the same way. The idea of creating content and helping people get better at their job, and people will remember that and remember your brand and come back to you and appreciate that. So one of the things that a lot of people, if they're doing any kind of optimization, typically do it within a channel. So they're going to do some optimization within, if they're using LinkedIn, they're going to use the LinkedIn tools, if they're Facebook, et cetera, or Google. So what's different about the approach of running these optimizations outside the individual digital engines? And I have 17 follow-up questions, but let's get to the first one.
Yeah. So you mentioned the main thing. So a couple of things. As everybody knows, the platforms themselves have their own, you know, algorithms that they use to optimize your campaigns. And so you can set it up a little bit based on what you're trying to do, what goals you're trying to achieve. And your campaign will go through a learning, some learning time, and then they'll start trying to optimize. And so our platform can actually take advantage of that. But obviously within Facebook, it's good within Facebook, and within LinkedIn is good within LinkedIn. But where it falls down is across, like what's actually working for you across these two. And in fact, like for us, for myself, because of the way that we build audiences in Facebook, which is very similar to how we build them in LinkedIn, we can get such targeted audiences on Facebook and then have the lower cost of that basically marketplace. Mm-hmm. So I end up in my stuff, I end up optimizing almost out of LinkedIn for a lot of the stuff that I do. So a lot of times you won't see my ads on LinkedIn because I've realized I can get to the same people at two-thirds lower cost, a third of the cost on Facebook. And I can get the same conversions. Now, it's not the exact same audience. My match rate's probably 30% instead of 50 or 60%, but it's better than any other way I can match to Facebook. And so that's really one of the bigger ones, is it'll really help you broker that budget across those two channels, because LinkedIn is really expensive. And so all of us B2B marketers are like, we have to do LinkedIn because that's where they all are. More of them are on Facebook. You know what I mean? And so everybody's on Facebook. And so if you can get them on, and by advertising on Facebook, you're also advertising on Instagram. So now you're pretty across channel. And then we also talk to people about budgeting on, have some go to Quora. So our platform doesn't automatically go to Quora, but we have optimizations and the CSM can say, here's some Quora ads that we can do. Google AdWords is another channel we're going to bring into the platform so that it can actually really see across those. And it's also, and this gets way too technical, but it's also just the way that our AI is set up. And so we're Facebook and LinkedIn are relying on groups of ads and things like that to optimize. We actually inject each one individually as an individual experiment, so we can see different types of data from those individual experiments. And so we have other types of ways that we can optimize based on how we pull the data out, even within a channel, not even across. But yeah, so we worked a lot. And what we do is we allow our clients to put kind of safeguards, thresholds in the platform. So it's like they can, it's almost like a stock trading platform a little bit. You can think of it like that, where you can almost stop.
Yeah, no runaway trades. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, so you can set thresholds around how much do I want to spend on an experiment if it doesn't generate at least a single lead? Like, how far am I willing to go to see if it's going to work? And you can put those limits in and other things. I can't remember all of them. There's lots of different limits. Obviously, your daily spend and all that stuff. But, oh, your range for cost per lead and those kinds of things you can plug in so that. So, yeah, it knows a little bit more about you and how you want to optimize than just how the system wants to do it.
Yeah, I imagine that there's also, if you take this approach of optimization outside of the proprietary channels, there's the advantage of data ownership. So you obviously you own the data, and there's also the advantage of proprietary data targeting as part of the optimization algorithm. So you can bring in stuff that's just not part of their thing. And that's
where our audience part really. So we have this huge audience, 1.4 billion profiles, and then LinkedIn has their audience. And so if you combine the two together, you get this like super audience. And so that's, and the same on Facebook, obviously doesn't have, you can do like personal interest queries and those kinds of things on Facebook, but we let people do B2B queries, industry, job title, et cetera. And then we've figured out how to do, our database is this personal to corporate identity graph. And so since everybody logs into Facebook using their personal email address, we have their business profile, and then we have their personal email addresses, all of them attached to that business profile. And when you create a segment that includes that person, we upload all of their personal email addresses to Facebook to guarantee like the best match possible. And so we never show anybody those email addresses, of course, because those are all PII, but that's really how we create audiences, B2B audiences on Facebook that unlock that for our customers.
Yeah. And how do you help your customers navigate through the data privacy rules and the ever-changing GDPR landscape? It's complicated. And it's one of the things that's just this existential risk that we all think about as a marketer. You don't certainly want to damage your reputation or run into some giant set of fines that may happen. So how do you think about that?
Yeah. So we have actual data protection attorneys, you know what I mean? That we had help us navigate all of that lovely content and all the rules. But what we do is we just don't expose it. We don't expose any PII to our customers. And so just through that alone, the only thing they see is they're querying for industries. They can actually query for people at a company, but they're not going to see the people. They're going to say this company with this job title, and they're never going to see the person's name or email address or anything else. And so that's really how we, and then we hash everything in the background. So if there were to be some kind of a breach, all of the PII we have is already hashed. And so it would be not, you know, it wouldn't be able to be reconstituted, I guess that's the right word. But yeah, you have to sign all these data protection agreements. And so we try and take on as much of that responsibility for our clients as we can, so they don't have to worry about it. But just legally, we have to sign data transfer agreements, data protection agreements, just to keep everybody, I guess, legally safe. But we haven't had any issues, which is nice. We don't have a lot of European clients yet, but we have US clients that target people in Europe. And yeah, it's no problem.
Great. Maybe a couple of quick questions, and I know we have to wrap pretty soon, but the one thing, do you have any sort of real tangible, what's the one thing that every data-based marketer should be doing right now that they may not be doing?
I would say if I had to choose one thing, that's hard.
You can pick two if you want. That's like a bonus.
I would say focus on that, who you're targeting, like really get really clear about how you build your target account list. But not only that, it's how you build the target account list, but you have to consider, I'm just gonna take 1 minute on this. You have to consider your unit economics. And this is the challenge I see a lot of companies making, is they say they define their target account list based on all the things that they know would make somebody ripe for the product. And they have no care and concern about the size of that target account list. And then they try and create a marketing plan that matches that target account list. And they realize I can only serve each person in that account a half of an ad because I didn't do my math to figure out like how many target accounts can I actually advertise to. And so that's the thing I'd say is I just see that almost every of our clients that I get into and help, I try and work them back up from that unit. Like I'm not, just make sure you understand how many people you can properly market to, especially if you need five touches or so from somebody with no awareness. Make sure you have enough resources and that your list isn't so big that you're serving half an ad to everybody.
Totally makes sense. That's great. We'll include some links and information to learn more about metadata.io. Really appreciate you sharing your expertise here with us, Jason. This has been really fascinating. Some really good tangible stuff. I think Kelsey has one more question and then we'll wrap up.
Yeah. So Jason, I'm interested to hear from your perspective as a marketing ops by trade. What advice would you give to CMOs or those aspiring to be one? Because there is a massive trend you would see of marketing ops becoming CMOs nowadays.
Yeah, I would say this. Yeah, here's what I'd say. I'd say I've seen two types of CMOs. They're not just two, but like really data-driven ones. And then ones that are like, I don't even want to see the data. I don't even know what to do with it. I'd say the ones that are very data-driven, don't go too far down that path because there's still so much marketing that we do that is not attributable to things. That's not a direct line to things. And so if you go all the way that side of the pendulum and you're just like, everything we need to do has to have an ROI, that's not great. That's just too far. And so you've got to be able to have things that are like good for the brand, good for your potential prospects and things that may not be like word of mouth. Like how are you going to treat, but you're going to try and do word of mouth programs and influencer programs and stuff. And so don't get so mired in the, I need to see a 1 + 1 = 2 that you basically select yourself out of a lot of other things you could do.
Great. Excellent advice. I really appreciate it. And I think with that, Kelsey, I think we're ready to wrap, right?
Yes, we are. Thanks so much for your time today, Jason. Really appreciate it. And make sure to follow the Next CMO and Plana on Twitter and LinkedIn. And if you have any ideas for topics or guests, you can visit our website or email them to thenextcmo@plana.com. Stay tuned for the next community launching soon and have a great day, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you.